Hello, this is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Baltimore on Q1370 WQLL. Catholic Baltimore is a weekly radio program hosted by the Archdiocese of Baltimore, airing each Sunday following the broadcast of the Radio Mass of Baltimore. We are grateful to our Catholic radio partners for sharing with us some of the contents in this program and for the opportunity to bring quality Catholic programming to the Archdiocese of Baltimore every Sunday.
I'm Sean Kane, and you're listening to Catholic Baltimore. In 2011, Bill Flax wrote an article for Forbes magazine on the doctrine of separation of church and state. In it, he wrote, "Our forefathers never sought to evict the church from society. They recognized that the several states did not share uniform values. We lived and worshiped differently. The framers were a diverse bunch with wildly divergent opinions on many issues, but eliminating the very foundations of America's heritage would have horrified them. On few issues was there more unanimity. Ensuring the Catholic Church in Maryland has a voice in the public square on the most important issues affecting the citizens of our state is the ultimate goal of the Maryland Catholic Conference, the Church's lobbying arm in Annapolis. Joining us again is the Executive Director of the Maryland Catholic Conference, Mary Ellen Russell. Welcome, Mary Ellen.
Morning, Sean.
So the last time we met, we were preparing for the legislative session, and thankfully, I'm sure to you, the session has just ended. So can you remind us of some of the legislative priorities for the Church in Maryland, and then maybe we can go through the outcomes for those one by one?
Sure. There were a number of really major issues this year. One, I think, that kind of came a little bit as a surprise, beginning particularly since it's the first year of a lot of new legislators' four-year term, was a bill to legalize physician-assisted suicide, which took up a lot of attention and time on the part of the church and other major advocates. We also spent a lot of time and energy working once again to try to advance the Maryland Education Credit, which would benefit lower and middle income families that attend Catholic schools and other non-public schools in the state, and actually would also benefit families of public school students. Another big issue were work-related issues, helping middle income families to have better access to job opportunities and work-related environments that are family-friendly. So we worked on a bill to pass paid sick leave, which didn't pass, but another one that helps people who encounter barriers to employment because of their minor criminal history records, called the Second Chance Act, and that's a bill we've worked on for a number of years that actually did pass this year.
So let's start with physician-assisted suicide. Maybe talk about what the bill that had been introduced sought to do, and then what the church's position was and how we were successful in defeating the legislation.
Well, the bill is actually, it's a very scary bill. The bill on its surface sounds compassionate, and that's what the advocates will tell you. But what the bill would do is essentially allow a doctor to legally prescribe a lethal prescription of drugs, which generally tends to be 90 pills that a patient would take if they've been diagnosed with 6 months or less to live with a terminal illness. One of the very scary things about the bill is there's absolutely no requirement that the patient who is asking to kill themselves be screened to see if they're simply suffering from depression, which is a very likely case if someone's just received a terminal diagnosis. So that was a concern that a lot of people had. The other problem with the bill is that I think, as everybody can speak from their own personal experience, a six-month diagnosis is a very, very inaccurate opinion of a doctor to rely upon to say that's the least amount of time that you have left to live. We all know people who've received a six-month diagnosis and are with us today and happily enjoying their families and have survived those diagnoses. One of the most famous persons who opposed this legislation in Massachusetts when they were considering was the widow of Ted Kennedy, Vicki Kennedy, whose husband also had received a four-month diagnosis and yet went on to live another year and a half and passed the Affordable Care Act. And she considered it just a travesty to think that people would be provided a prescription to kill themselves simply based on that.
And many in the medical community will even admit, you know, it's at best a guesstimate in terms of how long someone actually has to live.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think we could line up people at the table who said, you know, if I'd been given that, I was given that diagnosis and I was depressed, and if this possibility had been on the table, I wouldn't be here today to tell my story.
And, of course, proponents of the bill sought to use the highly publicized death of a young woman in Oregon, where physician-assisted suicide is legal, as a springboard, as a way of trying to convince people that this is a compassionate choice. Your office was pretty effective in countering that with another pretty high-profile person here who said just the opposite.
Exactly. And I think one of the reasons that the bill pretty much stopped dead in its tracks was the very, very powerful testimony of O.J. Brigance, the former Ravens player who was diagnosed 8 years ago with ALS, and who the nobility of this man's spirit is very, very powerful. And just the very fact that he said, I probably accomplished more over the past 8 years of my life than I did for the 30-some years I'd been alive before that, that, you know, we... just because we have a terminal, supposedly terminal illness, or a physical challenge doesn't mean that our lives aren't worthy and that we don't have much to offer the world. And I think the other group of people that were very effective in raising very serious concerns about the legislation were the disability community advocates for people with disabilities, who really questioned the whole premise of the bill that there is no reason to live when you're suffering some kind of a physical challenge or a physical disability or an illness. I think a lot of people came forward and said, this bill insults our community, basically, in what we're saying. In the medical community, I think also a lot of people from the medical community found it very troubling. I don't think doctors feel patients will trust them if this is an option on the table. And I think there's a lot of concern about people who already don't have access to adequate medical care, who fear they'll be pressured by a doctor saying, well, you know, this is a very inexpensive alternative compared to the treatment that you may want. So a lot of problems with the bill.
And obviously one of the great benefits of the process was the education of people of the church's teaching on the issue, what the concerns are about the bill. We know the bill will come back again, we suspect. A website has been developed. How can we continue to get the word out to people on this issue and share with them the concerns that we have about it?
Well, I think the best way for people to stay informed is to join the coalition that was created, which is a very broad coalition of all of these various people who have concerns with it, called the Maryland Against Assisted Suicide Coalition. Their website is www.stopassistedsuicidemd.org. And we really, really do need people to sign up, make sure that they're receiving information from them. They will receive information from us when we begin to organize again for the session starting next January. In particular, we really need people from the medical community and the palliative care community. I think that the alternative to this legislation is for people to really press for better palliative care at the end of life, better pain management, better opportunities for hospice and for people to know that they're loved and valued and that they're not a burden when they reach these end-of-life situations and that they deserve care, not a prescription to kill themselves.
Another highly contested issue, and one that we came out on the wrong end on, was the Maryland Education Credit a bill, which would have provided a tax credit for businesses donating to scholarship organizations that would have helped students in both public and non-public schools.
That's a bill that we've worked on for many years. It got a very strong extra push through the advocacy of Governor Hogan, who made it a priority for one of his legislative initiatives. We've been very grateful for the bipartisan support that we've received on the bill, especially from the lead sponsor in the Senate, Senator Ed DeGrange from Anne Arundel County, who is a real champion for all kids in both public and non-public schools. And to be perfectly honest, I mean, there is really no reason why this bill is not passing except for opposition from House leadership. It has the majority support of both the Senate and the House, and there's just one or two people standing in the way of that bill going through. And the governor, to his credit, did everything he could to push for it. He added extra money in the budget and tried to create a grant program when House leadership wouldn't let the bill out of committee. So we just need to keep pushing really, really hard on this issue.
So how can people listening to this show help get this bill passed next year?
We certainly encourage everyone to sign up also for the Maryland Catholic Conference's online advocacy network, which they can simply go to our website, www.mdcatholic.org, and look for the place where they can just click on and sign up for our online advocacy network. They really need to talk to their legislators. The legislators will be at home and meeting with groups and communities throughout the next several months until next January, and let them know how important this is. And I think try to be educated about the issue and not listen to the lies simply that opponents will tell about the issue, mostly that this bill would benefit both private and public school students. And that's something that gets buried in the rhetoric. It's a bill that would provide financial assistance to any family that is looking for ways to expand educational opportunities for their children. It's a very positive, win-win kind of bill, and we really need to fight against the rhetoric of the opponents.
Great. We've got about 1 minute left. If we can, let's talk about the Second Chance Act and what it sought to do and what the church's position was on it.
The Second Chance Act is a bill that would shield certain minor criminal convictions from a prospective employee's record when they're applying for a job. Importantly, the bill allows child-serving institutions to have full access to the background of a prospective employee, but it's a real balance of providing someone who's trying to turn their life around and become a productive member of society to get their foot in the door and have the opportunity to have a clean slate and to move forward to get the job that they need to move forward with their lives. Very, very important bill to us. And it did pass. It had some amendments. It got watered down a little bit, but we think it's a great first step.
Great. So to learn more about the work of the Maryland Catholic Conference and how you can get regular updates on just those issues of concern to you, please visit the Maryland Catholic website at mdcathcon, that's CATHCON.org. Mary Ellen Russell, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Sean.
Catholic news from the Archdiocese of Baltimore and around the world with the Catholic Review. On May 16th, Archbishop William E. Laurie ordained 8 men as permanent deacons at a mass at the Cathedral of Mary Our Queen in Homeland. Permanent deacons, who may be married, receive the sacrament of holy orders to become clergy members. They may proclaim the gospel, preach homilies, administer the sacrament of baptism, and witness marriage. They minister in parishes, charitable organizations, hospitals, prisons, and elsewhere. At CatholicReview.org and in our print newspaper, we talk to our 8 new deacons who come from a variety of backgrounds, including software engineering, forensic investigation, upper management, and owning a small business. Becoming a deacon, says Paul Nicholas of St. Anne in Hagerstown, has truly opened my heart, mind, and soul to the love of Christ and the richness, beauty, and truth of our faith. Also at CatholicReview.org and in print, we take a look at the life of Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero, who on May 23rd will be beatified, the final step before being recognized as a saint of the Catholic Church. We speak to 2 men, Rene Quintanilla and Mario Diaz, who lived in El Salvador when Archbishop Romero was assassinated in March of 1980. They remember a man of God who preached the gospel and spoke out against the injustice, severe poverty, kidnapping, and assassinations that were the norm in El Salvador at that time. Finally, for something light and upbeat, check out our coverage of the Cristo Rey Step Team, a group of students at the Fells Point High School who use their bodies as percussive instruments in a performance that pleases the eyes and ears. It's so appealing, in fact, that after seeing step performances, Cristo Rey's corporate partners are likely to offer even more internship positions for students. From the newsroom of the Catholic Review, this is Eric Zygmunt.
Do you want to know more about what's going on in the Catholic Church and the world than you can get from your daily newspaper or local TV? Read the only newspaper in the Archdiocese of Baltimore that covers the Catholic Church full-time, the Catholic Review. The print newspaper can be delivered to your home every other Thursday, and you can get fresh news every day online at CatholicReview.org. You can also read the inspirational Review in the Pew, ready for you every other Sunday at your local parish. Find the Catholic Review app on Apple and Android and follow the Catholic Review on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Wherever your faith takes you, Catholic Review Media is ready to inspire, teach, inform, and engage. Read it today, in print or online at CatholicReview.org.
You are listening to Catholic Baltimore on Q1370 WQLL.
I'm Sean Kane, and you're listening to Catholic Baltimore. Anyone who's ever visited Baltimore or taken visitors from out of town to dinner in the city has likely dined at one of the iconic Italian restaurants in Baltimore's Little Italy. And though some changes have occurred in and around this small section of the eastern boundary of the Inner Harbor, Little Italy remains a true ethnic enclave, a throwback to the city's old neighborhoods built largely by those immigrants who lived and worshiped together. So how has Little Italy managed to survive the demographic and other changes that have left other such neighborhoods a distant memory? And what makes this neighborhood so unique and special? These answers and much, much more can be found in a new book entitled Baltimore's Little Italy. Joining us today to discuss the book is Susanna Molino, whose grandparents emigrated from Abruzzi, Italy to Baltimore's Little Italy, and she serves as the director of the nonprofit Promotion Center for Little Italy. Susanna, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Sean, for having me.
Your book is a wonderful read and equally wonderful tribute to the Italian Catholic community of Little Italy. It must have been a true labor of love for you.
Thank you very much. It was definitely a true labor of love. And speaking of labor, it took me exactly 9 months, just like having a baby.
Very appropriate. So what made you decide to write the book?
It found me. It was actually not a decision, but the publisher was looking for a writer for this particular book. They contacted the Promotion Center for Little Italy. And I did put out a short call to say, is anyone interested? And no one really responded. So I put my hat in the ring. I said, I'm a writer, and filled out a book proposal. And we went forward with that.
So you do have writing in your background.
Absolutely. Yes. I have a long time freelance writing career with many published in many magazines and newspapers across the country.
Including our own Catholic Review.
Yeah, that's right.
So what were some of the biggest obstacles or challenges you faced in writing the book? I can't imagine it was an easy task, and I'm guessing it was probably more difficult than you even imagined at the beginning.
I felt the biggest frustration was having the time to meet with more people, to hear more stories, not being able to include everyone's stories and family names in the small book that the publisher afforded me only a certain amount of words. And there was so much more to tell. Mm-hmm. I had a very, very large binder full of information, and I couldn't even include half of it. That was frustrating. I feel like the other part was collecting the photographs. I put the call out. I had to submit 60 to 70 photographs, and many came back that were just not high quality enough. So it was a constant search, very tedious process. But we got it all done. It all came together.
Obviously, as I said at the beginning, your family has a long connection with Little Italy, and so you began the process with a good grasp of its history. But I imagine you encountered quite a few surprises and learned a lot along the way.
I did. I learned a lot of information about every topic in the table of contents, I have to say. I learned that the neighborhood was once very self-contained. Many people lived above their storefronts of whatever business that they had downstairs. There were bread bakers and shoe repair, street merchants, an ice man, a midwife, butcher shops, grocers, winemakers, the list goes on. And I learned that the Italian housewives hardly had to leave the neighborhood to get whatever or buy whatever they needed. When they did leave, they walked right over to Corned Beef Row. There were many, many Jewish vendors along there. And the Italians and the Jewish people lived cohesively and supported each other's businesses. I also was surprised to learn of that there used to be a St. Leo's Italian orphanage who took care of many children that was under the Archdiocese. That was a very interesting story to come across. Another little tidbit was that some of the street names are reminiscent of London towns. For the origin of the original people that came over were, Europeans in other parts, not in Italy, And so we have Stiles and Exeter and Albemarle streets and many
Italian
of those names.
Sounding names.
Exactly right. Yeah. And many of those names were origins of the first dwellers.
So the English, European Americans were preceded the Italian Americans in that neighborhood.
Correct. Irish, German, Jewish. Then the Italians, they all lived together, and then eventually it was taken over by all Italians.
So like all things Italian, your book is filled with great stories, and as you referenced, too many to tell for sure. What are some that stand out for you, some of your favorites in the book?
One of my favorites was about the Kelly and Poggi Italian Pharmacy. Now, we're going way back, so obviously I wasn't able to talk to him, but I did find a 1979 interview by one of his daughters, Julia. She was born in 1909, so she was old at the time when she did this interview. She greatly described the compassionate and kind man that her father was and how he treated his customers, who were, of course, the neighbors. Often he wouldn't take their money. Many were poor. He was a pharmacist, a psychiatrist. He was everything to everyone. And one of my favorite little tales about him was he once concocted a love potion for a man named John in the neighborhood who wanted to win the heart of a girl named Rose. Now, of course, Mr. Poggi only filled a container with sugar water, maybe a little confidence, and he gave it to John, and those two did end up getting married.
Hmm. That's amazing.
After he died, the two spinster sisters took over the space, Julia and Mary, and even people around today remember them and the storefront that they had, which was a soda fountain and a card shop. And people still do remember going in there. I have a favorite story about the hurdy-gurdy. Mr. Jean had the last hurdy-gurdy. Unfortunately, Mr. Jean died when I was writing the story. I was never even able to get a quote from him. I had some former quotes from him.
And what is a hurdy-gurdy?
A hurdy-gurdy is a musical organ
box.
And the one that I saw Mr. Jean play is a great big one. It was one of the ones his grandfather lugged all around Baltimore City, and he and his brother played it, and that's how they earned their money. People would throw money at them out the window or as they were walking along. And after a while, of course, when radio came into being, it was no need for it anymore. Those two gentlemen had 16 hurdy-gurdies, and they rented them out for like a dollar a day for family parties and things like that. I just love that story because, you know, it's something you don't see nowadays, someone walking up and down the street playing music for pleasure. That thing weighed 648 pounds, not counting the wagon, and they lugged it all over Baltimore City, one time up to Towson.
Oh, my.
On foot.
Really going out there. Just as the restaurants of Little Italy are kind of an iconic image, so too is St. Leo's Catholic Church. The community seems to have a very unique sense of responsibility to the parish, a unique relationship with it, and certainly values it as a center of the community, not just for a place to go for Mass or a wedding. How do you treat St. Leo's in your book, and did you notice the church keep coming back in many of the stories that people were telling you?
It did, absolutely. It was intertwined in most stories. It is the hub, the pulse, the heart of that neighborhood. I opted to write about St. Leo's first because I knew it would be the biggest chapter. Obviously, the oldest, beginning in 1881. I listed a lot of firsts, like the first altar boy, the first funeral, the first baptism, the first mass. I listed some of its restorations, some of its noteworthy features. Of course, St. Leo's School, that closed in 1980. I have a few interesting nun stories in there that people shared with me, told by former students. We talk about the ravioli dinners, the history of the Feast of St. Anthony, the Feast of St. Gabriel, which are still going strong today, the two summer Italian festivals. And then, of course, the Reverend Orest Pandola Learning Center. That was founded in 1996. So that is the largest chapter in the book, is about St. Leo's.
Well, the book again is Baltimore's Little Italy, Heritage and History of the Neighborhood, and it's written by Susanna Rosa Molino. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Sean.
Join Archbishop William Laurie for a special Mass on Memorial Day, Monday, May 25th at 10 a.m. The Mass will be celebrated at New Cathedral Cemetery, 4300 Old Frederick Road in Baltimore, to honor the men and women who died while serving in the armed forces. During this special Mass, we will also remember and pray for our family members and friends who have died and give thanks for the many ways they have enriched our lives. We hope you will join us this Memorial Day.
Life can be hard, and at times we feel overwhelmed and alone. When faced with problems, know that there is a group of Catholics who are part of the prayer ministry of the Archdiocese of Baltimore, waiting to lift you and your needs to God in prayer. This ministry is comprised of men and women, young and old, religious and lay, from every ethnic and cultural background. They pray as individuals and in groups, in homes and meeting spaces throughout Baltimore. Like you, they are people who have suffered the same hurts, fears, pains, sickness, loss, and everyday burdens. Learn more about this ministry by visiting our website at www.archbalt.org. If you are in need of prayer, send your prayer request to prayers@archbalt.org or by phone to 410-547-5517. Would you like to volunteer to be a part of the ministry? Prayer ministers are always needed. Please call or email our coordinator, who would be happy to speak with you.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Catholic Baltimore. As we prepare for the week ahead, let us do so in prayer together as one community of faith. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Let us also ask the blessing and intercession of our Blessed Mother as we pray. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. May God bless us and keep us always in his love.